For Monday, June 12, 2006, this is Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Human rights groups call for an investigation into the suicide of three detainees at Guantanamo Bay. After a weekend of heavy Israeli shelling, Palestinians continue to look for solutions to their own internal struggle. And we'll take a look at the U.S.-South Korea free trade talks and what it could mean for farmers in both countries. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The American Civil Liberties Union's lawsuit against the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping program went to court today in Detroit. The White House has asked U.S. District Judge Anna Diggs Taylor to dismiss the case, citing national security concerns. The lawsuit, filed on behalf of journalists, academics, and nonprofit organizations, argues that wiretapping of telephone and email communications without a court order violates the constitutionally protected rights to privacy and free speech. The Bush administration defends the program, saying that it is legal under broad new powers granted to the president by Congress after September 11th. A similar lawsuit filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York has not yet gone to court. In other legal news, the Supreme Court has ruled in favor of a death row inmate in Florida who wants to challenge execution by lethal injection as a cruel and unusual punishment. From WMNF in Tampa, Andrew Stelzer has more.
The ruling in favor of Clarence Hill allows a court challenge to move forward against lethal injection, the method of execution being used in 38 of the 39 states which employ the death penalty. Hill, who was convicted of killing a police officer in 1982, was minutes away from execution in January when the Supreme Court decided to take up his petition for the right to proceed in a lower court. Hill's attorneys had been arguing that the three chemicals used for lethal injection cause pain, thus violating the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment, but a Florida appeals court was refusing to hear the case. Now that case will be heard. Mark Elliott is the spokesperson for Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.
What this means is there will be no more executions in Florida throughout 2006. And the more time that we have in Florida to look at the death penalty without this ongoing death machine killing captive prisoners, the more likely we are to see the truth behind this.
Over the past few months, several states had already put all executions on hold, and many more may choose to do so rather than have numerous challenges tied up in court. There are 3,300 inmates currently on death row. Any one of them is now free to claim their pending execution violates civil rights law. For FSRN, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Scientists have found a new strain of mad cow disease in cattle in Texas and Alabama. Mad cow disease, or bovine spongiform encephalopathy, is thought to be transmitted when cattle eat the tissue of infected cows, as cattle remains are sometimes added to animal feed. However, scientists are unable to explain the path of infection for the new atypical strain, and some suspect that the new strain may be contagious from animal to animal. In Indian-administered Kashmir, at least 10 people have been killed and many others injured in a spate of violent attacks today. Shanwas Khan has the details.
Unidentified gunmen killed 8 non-Kashmiri laborers today in Badru village in Anantnag, Kashmir. Police said guerrillas first abducted a group of laborers hailing from the Indian state of Bihar and later fired indiscriminately at them, killing 6 on the spot and injuring 7. 2 more succumbed to injuries in the hospital. The Press Trust of India news agency added there were unconfirmed reports that the laborers were killed in exchange of fire between security forces and militants. Earlier today, one person was killed and 20 injured in Kashmir's winter capital, Jammu, when suspected guerrillas threw 3 grenades near a bus terminal this morning. In a separate incident, a boy was killed when police opened fire to disperse a mob protesting the alleged desecration of a mosque in Kupwara in North Kashmir. Scores of people were also injured in this incident. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shanawaz Khan.
The Sudanese government has agreed to collaborate with the International Criminal Court to arrest the LRA rebel leader Joseph Kony, operating in northern Uganda. Joshua Chilimba reports.
Talks between the rebel delegation and Ugandan government officials were expected to start this week in the southern Sudan town of Juba. But in a statement yesterday, the UN Court's chief prosecutor Luis Moreno Campo said Sudan has voluntarily agreed to execute the warrants issued by the International Criminal Court. Ocampo has dismissed attempts to negotiate a political deal, saying Konyi was simply trying to buy time like he has done in the past. Konyi is wanted by the Hague-based court, along with Rascal Rukwiya, Vincent Oti, Okoti Odhiambo, and Dominic Ongwen, to answer to charges of crimes against humanity. The LRA, listed as a terrorist organization by the U.S., has spread terror in northern Uganda and southern Sudan for almost 20 years, mostly targeting civilians and forcefully abducting thousands of children for sex slavery and recruitment into the rebel outfit. Joshua Charimpa, FSRN, Kampala.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. military cordoned off the western Iraqi city of Ramadi over the weekend in preparation for an all-out military assault. 400,000 people live in Ramadi, and as FSRN's Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib report, thousands of civilians remain trapped inside without food, water, or electricity.
Adnan Dulaimi is head of one of the largest Sunni Arab political movements in Iraq. He's a professor of Arabic literature in Baghdad now, but in his earlier days he taught secondary school in Ramadi. He says the situation in Ramadi has been dire for some time.
All the basic necessities of life are difficult to get. Water and electricity are almost impossible, and this is increasing the amount of violence because the people want revenge, because they think the Americans are responsible. And the violence creates more violence and makes the situation worse. It's not beneficial for the Iraqi people, and it's not useful for the Americans also. So they have to stop it.
But the U.S. military is moving in the opposite direction. After the killing of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi last week, the Los Angeles Times reports U.S. and Iraqi forces cordoned off the city. Airstrikes on several residential areas picked up, and troops took to the streets with loudspeakers to warn civilians of a fierce impending attack. In his weekly radio address, President Bush said the American military is on the offensive.
Coalition and Iraqi forces are seizing this moment to strike the enemies of freedom in Iraq at this time of uncertainty for their cause. The work ahead will require more sacrifice and the continued patience of the American people.
But many Iraqis worry an American attack on Ramadi will be a replay of the 2004 assault on Fallujah, where foreign fighters fled the city ahead of the major assault, taking over huge swaths of territory, while thousands of civilians remain trapped in the city, with hundreds killed by American forces. Again, Sunni politician Adnan Dulaimi.
There are many things happening in Ramadi. There's killing, bad security, and there are a lot of criminals. But that's not a good reason to bomb everybody. The fighters will find a way to leave because they are fighters. But the people left behind will be the old people who can't leave, the children, and the poor. All the people who don't have relatives to go to, which is the majority of Ramadi's people. Maybe 10% will be able to leave. Only the civilians will be killed.
The siege of Ramadi has at least the tacit support of the new Iraqi government. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki told reporters he would try to negotiate with tribal leaders and the people of Ramadi, but that force would be used as a last resort. Fadl Ashara, spokesman for the Sadr movement.
If the raids are just for the sake of raiding the city, of course we will not support it. But if it's just to arrange the security of the city without hurting people and with respecting people's lives and people's dignity, we have a different perspective on that. I prefer that the Iraqi military would run the operations. That would be better than the Americans.
Adnan Dulaimi predicts more attacks on American soldiers after an assault on Ramadi, along with more sectarian violence, as Sunnis across the country see the elected Shia-dominated government attacking one of the largest Sunni cities in the country. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
Human rights groups and attorneys representing detainees at Guantanamo Bay are calling for an independent investigation into the suicides of three inmates over the weekend. Attorneys say suicide attempts at Guantanamo are common. Meanwhile, the Bush administration continues to dismiss the suicides as politically motivated. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Attorneys for detainees at the detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, are not surprised at the news of the suicides.
The deaths this weekend were predictable and inevitable.
Gitanjali Gutierrez is a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
They are numb, depressed, desperate. Many of them are suffering extreme psychological effects from indefinite detention. They have utter uncertainty about their fate and lives to this day in June of 2006.
Gutierrez places all blame on the United States for running what she calls an illegal and inhuman detention center.
The Bush administration has the stain of injustice on their hands for these deaths. We cannot, our government cannot tolerate what this is doing to our reputation throughout the world and what this is doing to the humanity of the men in Guantanamo, many of whom do not belong there and never belonged there.
The Center for Constitutional Rights, or CCR, represented two of the three men who died over the weekend at the military detention base, Yasser Talal al-Zahari from Saudi Arabia and Ahmed Abdullah from Yemen. The third, Shaman Alabardi Alatabi, also from Saudi Arabia, had been given a transfer to another country. It is unclear if he was aware of that development at the time of his death. The Department of Defense has called this an act of asymmetric warfare. In their press release, it painted all three of these men as active militants in Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, and that they were defiant throughout their imprisonment and participants in hunger strikes. General John Craddock, commander of U.S. Southern Command in Miami, at a news conference this past weekend.
They continue to do everything they can to accomplish what their intent here is, which I think is to become martyrs in the jihad.
Attempted suicides are said to be common at Guantanamo. The Pentagon admitted to nearly 450 incidences of what they call self-harm by detainees. Self-harm is also a definition for a suicide attempt. That number is from when Guantanamo opened in 2002 through 2004. CCR attorney Joshua Colin Hale O'Brien witnessed one attempt by his client, Juma al-Dosri, a Bayrani who was picked up in Pakistan and brought to Guantanamo in early 2002.
I opened the door to this room, and the first thing I saw on the floor in front of me was a pool of blood. I looked up and saw Juma hanging by his neck from the inside of this steel mesh wall separating the meeting area from the cell. I took one step and was immediately next to him, although still separated by the mesh. I yelled his name, but I could see that he was unconscious, he wasn't breathing, he didn't respond at all. I also saw that he had a large gash on his right arm, which had caused the bleeding on the floor and had also caused him to bleed on himself.
Al-Dosri lived and has attempted suicide multiple more times, claiming he can no longer live under the oppression that the system has broken him. Leonard Rubinstein with the group Physicians for Human Rights says more suicides are expected because of the detainees' conditions.
The International Committee of the Red Cross in 2003 warned that the interrogation techniques used combined with the conditions of confinement were creating a huge potential for harm and self-harm to detainees. When it returned in 2004, it found that severe mental illness had significantly increased at Guantanamo from their last visit.
Attorneys and human rights groups are calling for an independent investigation into the deaths. They are also calling for the close of Guantanamo or to give detainees access to the U.S. court system. The Bush administration has said in the past they are waiting for a Supreme Court ruling in the case Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, whether the U.S. will permit a detainee's case to be heard in the U.S. courts. That decision is expected this month. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
From his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
When suicide ain't. When news broke of the spate of suicides at the U.S. Torture Center at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, the response of Bush administration officials provides, at a glance, insight into their long train of failure in the so-called war on terror. The The U.S. government response to the successful suicides of three detainees was twofold. First, they killed themselves to embarrass the government. And second, their suicides are de facto acts of war. When I heard these responses, my mouth dropped open in sheer disbelief. That's because over these long years in prison and on death row, I've seen more than my share of suicides, as well as unsuccessful attempts. Invariably, these acts came from men who had nothing to live for and who had reached the end of their rope. For them, death was a release from pain and suffering. Moreover, as human rights lawyer Michael Ratner has shown in his 2004 book, Guantanamo, What the World Should Know, there are demonstrably innocent men being held as so-called enemy combatants in Guantanamo. Ratner cites the March 2004 release of five British citizens who, upon arrival in England, were released almost immediately. Ratner noted, "You can be sure these five Britishers were not guilty of anything at all, or the British would have put them on trial." Ratner, noting that these men spent years under brutal detention, said the five British cases reflects on other ones. And this is not just about the loss of years of these people's lives, or about whatever brutalities they may have undergone while they were in custody. Think of what it says about everyone else who is in Guantanamo. The United States has released a few of the many hundreds of people there, but many of the detained prisoners in Guantanamo, like those Britishers, may be innocent of any crime whatsoever. There's another reason why it's doubtful that these men were the jihadis that the government claims they were. In Afghanistan, U.S. military forces dropped leaflets offering large sums of money for terrorists. Afghans pointed out people and took the money. The problem is they were motivated by money, not truth. So poor people, tribal enemies, farmers, taxi drivers, etc., got roped into the net. A military interrogator at Camp Delta estimates 20% of detainees in Guantanamo are innocent. 20%. Yet they languish in conditions that a British court has called a legal black hole. Given such conditions, beatings, humiliations, desecration of one's faith and personhood, abduction to a strange country, and secret imprisonment, without hope, is it strange for one to see suicide as an act of war or as simply suicide to free oneself from impossible conditions? The great psychologist Sigmund Freud once quipped, "Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar." Well, sometimes suicide is suicide. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
This weekend marked continued Israeli shelling into Gaza, in which 11 Palestinians were killed on Friday, one Saturday, and three apparent resistance fighters were assassinated by an Israeli missile on Sunday. As Syed Banoura reports, various Palestinian factions are struggling to negotiate a plan that will ensure the country's national unity.
We should try to remind Palestinians that internal fighting is not an option.
Hassan Andoni, former political prisoner.
And that we should be united regardless of our political differences and differences in vision. We should be united against any attempt to send us to that direction.
The so-called prisoner's proposal, an 18-point call for Palestinian national unity drafted by a number of Palestinian political prisoners in Israel, has become the centerpiece of the debate on Palestinian internal unity. But yesterday, a number of the original signatories revoked their signatures, saying that the document had been manipulated by President Mahmoud Abbas and turned into the basis for a referendum by which he hopes to regain power. Hamas representative Aziz Dwake.
The presidential decree calling for a referendum remains illegal for a number of reasons, including the fact that it goes against the Palestinian basic law.
Talks between the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh from the rival Fatah and Hamas parties respectively will resume tonight after a legislative session today outlined the differences in the two major parties' approaches. Hanan Ashrawi, an independent Palestinian legislator.
There are parties who are interpreting the law in a political way to promote their own interests. Each side tries to explain his position, But the fact is there are prejudices regarding the law, instead of allowing the legislative path just to take its course.
The referendum planned by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas for July 25th is, in his words, a way to appease the Israeli authorities who are in control of Palestine, to try to convince them to end the ongoing siege on the Palestinian people, a siege that has resulted in high rates of malnutrition due to lack of food for the last 4 months, according to the United Nations. The Israeli leadership, however, has stated that even if the referendum were to pass, the economic siege on Palestine would continue, and the military occupation of Palestine, stepped up in recent days, would not cease. For FSRN, this is Saed Banoura in Beit Sahour, Palestine.
The United States and South Korea have started their first round of talks towards a bilateral free trade agreement amid a mix of cheers from some business groups and protests from farmers and labor groups in both nations. DC Radio Co-op's Reem Kakuda has more.
After successfully oiling the way to free passage of goods and an easy access to markets with so-called free trade agreements with Canada and many Latin American countries, the United States government turns its attention now to Asia, starting the first round of Korea-US FTA talks in Washington, D.C., wrapping up their week-long negotiations, which tries to reduce barriers to bilateral trade, which totaled around $73 billion last year. Some 300 delegates from both nations, headed by Assistant U.S. Trade Representative Wendy Cutler and South Korea's Trade Ambassador Jim Jong-hoon, say they have made some major headway in 9 sectors. Meanwhile, a delegation of 60 Korean farmers, unionists, economists, teachers, and artists, joined by many U.S. leaders from Change to Win, the AFL-CIO, and many fair trade activists, have been protesting these talks loudly all over town in Washington, D.C. Accompanied by drummers from South Korea, they staged fake farmers' funerals in front of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the USTR, and stormed Cargill's giant U.S. agribusiness offices, saying they hold these organizations responsible for the suicide of many South Korean farmers driven to bankruptcy by U.S. trade practices in their country. They're demanding fair trade agreements that would protect workers and their distinctive cultures, not just the company's interests, says Mr. Kyo So of Washington, D.C., one of the organizers.
Many feel that the FTA, if negotiated, will be harsh to Korean people. Despite the promise of economic benefits, the sectors who get loses out are the wage earners, the urban poor, and the farmers.
Despite official announcement of guaranteed labor protection and rights, the protesters are still worried for the livelihood of both countries and talk of unifying the struggles.
Under Bush administration, such neoliberalism and militarism are taking place violently and widely.
Professor Cho Hee of the Korean Progressive Academic Council.
And because of such a situation, ironically, under George Bush, anti-globalization and anti-war for peace struggle synergizes each other and became a one strong movement.
The CORIS FTA talks will resume in July in Seoul, where the police is worried that the protest might turn violent. I'm Reem Katkhuda of the DC Radio Co-op.org.
According to New York City's Youth Services Committee head, Lou Fidler, the number of homeless teens in the city hovers at around 7,000. Yet there are only about 300 shelter beds to serve them. And despite the fact that almost half of all homeless youth identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, there are less than 50 beds available in LGBT-friendly shelters. Last year, New York City allocated $1.2 million to address that problem, and the funds were divided equally among 3 small LGBT-friendly centers that provide temporary housing and comprehensive services. This year, the mayor's proposed budget has removed this funding. FSRN's Leanne Stanky reports from the Big Apple, where Councilperson Fidler and others at City Hall are fighting to have the money restored.
San Francisco, LA, New York. These large cities, which have a reputation for tolerance, are often a destination for young lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth. Many teens arrive with a few belongings tossed into a bag after their parents discover their sexual identity. Bridget, a lesbian-identified, formerly homeless youth, was asked to leave her home when she was a preteen, when her mother found her kissing another young woman.
My mom kicked me out. Simple as that. It was pretty much like,
you know, a teen coming into themselves and her not being able to deal and bear. So she just said, I'd rather have someone else deal with it and deal with the headache than me.
Carl Siciliano is the director of the Ali Fornay Center, a small emergency housing program for LGBT youth aged 16 to 24. He says that Bridget's story is common.
Not only do they have no money and no food, but they have no wallets and no identification. A real common story that I hear is that the parents find out that the kid is gay, and that night they're told to put their belongings in a garbage bag and hit the streets.
For Bridget, homelessness necessitated that she enter the underground economy.
Survival of the fittest, I had a what you call hustle. You know, do all kinds of things. You know, get little rinky-dinky jobs, manipulate people, sometimes even escort. You know, you don't know. You're not old enough to have fit survival skills to be able to budget and things of that nature. You learn that as you get older. I'm 11, 13 years old, out on my own. You use what you know, which isn't very much at that age.
Bridget's story is echoed around the country. There are an estimated 7,000 homeless youth sleeping on the streets in New York and as many as 10,000 in Los Angeles County. A disproportionate number of these young people identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. New York City Councilperson Lou Fidler is fighting to provide safe housing and queer-friendly services for this underrepresented group.
When you analyze the number of kids who are sleeping on the street of the city of New York, estimates run as high as 50% coming from that community.
According to Fidler, chair of the Youth Services Committee, statistics regarding who is sleeping in shelter beds indicate that LGBT youth are afraid to stay at large shelters like Covenant House, where homophobia is rampant.
The single provider of shelter beds for runaway and homeless youth in the city of New York only estimates that 3% of their population is LGBT, which indicates that they're clearly missing the mark or that the LGBT community doesn't feel comfortable at that provider.
Kate Barnhart is the manager of Sylvia's Place, a 10-bed emergency facility in Midtown Manhattan serving homeless LGBT youth. Many young people find their way to Sylvia's Place after a disturbing stay at Covenant House.
Well, a lot of the young people who come here come in with horror stories from Covenant House of being verbally or physically harassed by both peers and staff. I've had one young man who showed up here black and blue from head to toe because he had been beaten up and the staff had not intervened.
Bridget agrees. She experienced both physical and verbal harassment during her brief stay at Covenant House.
When I've had people sit there and like threaten to throw blow dryers in the shower when I was taking a shower, I've had people put urine and bleach in my shampoo. I've had people rip up my clothes. I've had people sit there and like wait for me to come home from work. And like, because I would usually come home like around 10, 11 o'clock, wait for me outside and like throw cigarettes at me.
Many queer youth say they'd rather spend the night on the street than go back to Covenant House, which is why Councilperson Fidler is lobbying for the city to continue providing for this population. At present, the mayor has eliminated $1.2 million that was earmarked for homeless LGBT youth from his proposed 2007 budget. Fidler would like to see these funds restored, and he's also seeking an additional $1.2 million for services provided by centers like Ali Fornay. These services are effective but costly, which is why Fidler and his colleagues are asking not only to restore the funding, but to add an increase. The budget is being evaluated now and is expected to be finalized on July 1st. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Stanky in New York.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Ada Bogado.